Welcome back. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Last week, on August 15th, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program went into effect through an executive order by President Obama. Some people are calling it the DREAM Act Lite. Unlike the proposed DREAM Act, it does not provide a path to citizenship for young undocumented students who grew up in the U.S. Instead, the Deferred Action program provides a limited path to employment for some immigrant youth. Though there are strict qualifications for eligibility, already tens of thousands of young people have lined up in cities around the country to apply for the right to work legally in the U.S. for 2 years. And the government expects 1.7 million in total to apply. Deferred action may be a move on Obama's part to win the Latino vote, but Obama's first term has not exactly been a boon for immigration reform. More than 1 million people were deported from the U.S. between 2009 and 2011. And in the last several years, some of the harshest immigration laws have been passed at the state level, most notably in Arizona and Alabama. And the Dreamers generation, young, undocumented people and their allies, have repeatedly seen their dreams, well, deferred. So what will deferred action really do for young undocumented people in the U.S.? Is it a step toward a more comprehensive immigration reform policy? To talk about all of this, we have Julianne Hing, who is a reporter and blogger for colorlines.com, and she covers immigration, education, criminal justice, and occasionally fashion and pop culture. Welcome, Julianne.
Thanks for having me.
A pleasure to have you here. And Jose Arriola is outreach manager with Educators for Fair Consideration. He was born in Durango, Mexico, and came to the United States when he was only 4 years old. Jose went on to study political science, history, and ethnic studies at Santa Clara University, where he received a full scholarship. And during his college career, Jose was an outspoken leader on campus. As an undocumented student himself, Jose uses his experiences to help empower and support other undocumented students across the country. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back, I should say. And I believe we've got Laura Lopez on the line. She's originally from Mexico and resides in Napa. She's co-founder of Students Informing Now. It's SEEN, and it was the first AB 540 Undocumented Student Support Group at UCSC. She is scholarship coordinator and student legal advocate with Educators for Fair Consideration. Welcome, Laura.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And I'll give out the number for our audience to join us in just a few minutes. But first, let me turn to you, Jose. The last time you were on our show, the DREAM Act was being considered in Congress, and there was a big hope that it would be passed. It was not passed. Between then and now, how has that affected you, the fact that this didn't pass?
The fact that the DREAM Act didn't pass?
Yeah.
Well, I think it definitely is challenging. I mean, I think I still, and a lot of us in the movement, still have hope, an enormous amount of hope, and are still working towards that. It's something that we continue to need, something that our community needs, something that our youth needs, and we're going to continue to do that. And in the meantime, we need to figure out a way to open up resources, help progress local policy, state policy, something like the California DREAM Act, which is a really great victory for us here in California. And we're going to continue to do that and continue to push for reform at the federal level.
So I want us all to get into the details of the deferred action and how that works and what the pros and cons are. But before we do that, I think that a lot of the time when we talk about immigration reform and we talk about undocumented people, we leave out the people part. It's really an abstraction. And so I was just wondering if you and maybe Laura and Julianne, who's reported on this, can you give us a sense of what it means to live here in the U.S. without legal status? What does that actually mean on a day-to-day basis? How does that affect your life?
Sure. Well, I can talk about that in the context of my own life. I think what was most challenging is the constant instability and fear. When I had learned about my status, I learned it very early. I think my parents were very honest with me from a very young age.
So how young?
About 5 years old.
Okay.
You know, so pretty
shortly
much when
after
I got
coming here.
Here. Mm-hmm. They let me know what my status was, but the only way they were able to really communicate, or the only way I was able to understand it when as a child, is that if I were to tell anyone where I was from, or if I were to tell anyone where I was born or where my family was born, that people would come and take my mother and father away forever. And that, as a five-year-old child, was an incredible burden for me to have to bear, to have to go to school every single day and not know whether or not my mother or father would still be there when I got home that afternoon. I think was an enormous burden to carry, and I continue to carry it throughout my life. Obviously, my own stability in this country, to know that regardless of how hard I've worked or what I've accomplished or my college degree, that I could still be removed, that I could still be deported. I think all of those things are incredible kind of mental challenges for me. And I mean, Laura can speak about her experience.
Laura, do you want to add anything to that? Just day to day? I mean, even going to college.
Definitely. I think for myself, I as well as Jose, I understood that I was undocumented at a very early age. My parents went through a cancellation of their deportation when I was about fifth and sixth grade. So I understood that we were in a mixed status family. So my parents are legal residents. They just got their citizenship appointment, so to go take the test. And my siblings are all citizens. So I have four. And for me, I thought that immigration had only to do with working. So I always knew that my mom worked as a nanny, as a janitor, my dad in the kitchen at diverse restaurants here in Napa. And for me, I thought that, well, college has nothing to do with my immigration status. But without the legislation AB 540, I would have had to pay out-of-state tuition at UC Santa Cruz. And in fact, they were classifying me as an out-of-state student. And it was dumbfounding because I've lived in California since I was a year and 8 months old. I was a toddler when I came here, so I couldn't fathom the idea of being considered an outsider when I've been here all of my life. So even there, it's been difficult trying to pay for college, being that I can at least pay in-state tuition, but that I could be considered literally a foreigner when I don't feel that way.
And I think that that's something that a lot of undocumented young people talk about. Jose Antonio Vargas wrote this very moving piece in Time recently, and I think he said... he said something to the effect that we love this country, we contribute to it, this is our home, and that's something that I think that in the abstract immigration debate, people forget about. So how do you consider your identity, Jose? How do you consider yourself?
Well, I mean, I guess I try as best I can to reflect on myself as a complete and complex human being, with interests, with challenges, with different various experiences. Obviously, being undocumented is one of them, and a very large one for me. But it's not the only one. And so I try to, as best I can. I think a really wonderful piece of advice that was given to me in my organizing work early on after I graduated from college was that I needed to somehow be able to find beauty in the struggle, which means that I needed to find love, I needed to find belonging, I needed to find purpose and happiness in the struggle, because the struggle is not going away anytime soon. So I think that's kind of how I reflect on myself in a very complex way. And different people know me in different circumstances, in different instances, different gifts and talents that I have.
Do you think of yourself as an American?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really complex, I think, answer, right? And I'd love to have a whole day where we can deconstruct that. But I think I'm American. I think I'm Mexican. I think I'm a son. I think I'm a brother. I think I have a lot of different identities.
So you can hold these multiple identities.
Absolutely. And we all do.
Yeah, exactly. Laura, you said that you're the only person in your immediate family without legal status. Is that accurate?
That's correct. In 2004, my parents were able to obtain their permanent legal residency. Throughout that process of cancellation, they had work permits, but it was very uncertain whether they'd get the permanent status, and they did in 2004. Because of that, they were able to apply for my own process to start. So I've been in the process since 2004, and because of the backlog in issuing this kind of a status, I have about 20 more years to go. That's the estimate I've received from attorneys.
And I think that's something that a lot of people also don't realize. They say, well, just get in line, but they're not realizing how long that line is. Julianne?
Yeah, there are several things that I would say. I think that one thing that folks should know is that the experiences that we're hearing about right now, you know, from Jose and Laura, are really typical. You know, this idea of this reality of living in a mixed status family. You know, I often in my reporting, I hear a lot of people say, why don't folks just leave and go back home? What's the harm in picking up your family and just going back to wherever country you were born in? But the reality is that most families, most immigrant families in the U.S. are mixed status families. So, you know, you have grandparents who are citizens and grandchildren who are not, and people are living and supporting each other. And the other thing is that, you know, I think that Jose spoke really beautifully to the mental realities of what it means. But in my reporting work, the things that have really struck me the most have been the day-to-day practical parts of just living that I think many people who have legal status take for granted. I drove here to the studio today. I have a driver's license. People who are undocumented in many states are barred from having driver's licenses, must rely on public transit. Students like Laura, if you're not recognized as an in-state resident, that means that you must pay 2 to 3 times the tuition of your peers who you've grown up next to, who
sometimes your siblings.
Right, who you've gone to schools with, who are your neighbors and classmates. And the other thing that folks should know is that undocumented students are barred from accessing federal aid and grants. And so, just getting an education, just being able to pay for an education, that becomes a central barrier to getting through school. So there are a lot of these very practical things that I think most people aren't aware of.
That's Julianne Hing. She's a reporter and blogger for colorlines.com. We're also joined by Jose Arreola and Laura Lopez. They're both with Educators for Fair Consideration, and they're both undocumented. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and I want to invite our callers to join our conversation. You can call 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. If you are undocumented and you've been in the U.S. most of your life, or you know somebody who is, how does that affect you on a daily basis? And how does this deferred action program change your situation? We'll explain it in just a few moments. And deferred action is being called the Dream Act Lite. Is it better than nothing, or is it potentially dangerous for undocumented young people? 866-798-8255 is our toll-free number. And if you're somebody who is against the Dream Act, why don't you please call and engage in polite conversation with our panel? 866-798-8255 is the number to call. And so we were just talking about the fact that you, Jose, and you, Laura, are out. And in this Time article, Jose Antonio Vargas says that that's been a real shift, a kind of game changer. He hopes that it will be, that there are young people who are coming out of the shadows and saying, I am undocumented, and trying to take the abstraction out of this equation. What are the dangers of doing that? I mean, now they've said that the Obama administration has said that they will not deport anybody who would be eligible for the DREAM Act. But it still seems risky.
Sure, it's always a risk. And I think that risk is really dependent upon what region of the country you're in as well. I think here in the Bay Area and here in California, we have a much more of a progressive and welcoming, or at least very aware political climate. Whereas in other states, I think it might be a lot more of a risk. I think what me and Laura has been doing this for longer than I have, and so many tens of thousands of others around the country have done, is to say, look, we recognize that this is a risk. This is a risk to us personally, a risk to our own futures and aspirations, but we need to. We have to, because as long as we remain invisible, as long as we remain in the shadows, our needs won't be met, and no one will understand what it really means to be undocumented in this country. I mean, you asked me earlier if I consider myself American. So yes, I consider myself American, but my America looks very different than other folks. What I see on a day-to-day basis, the experiences that I've had and the experiences of my family, the experiences of folks that I'm interacting with almost on a daily basis throughout the country, and all the struggles and challenges that they have to face as a result of their immigration status.
Expand on that. My America looks different than yours.
Well, in my America, I was welcomed into my first year of college by both my mother and father being put into deportation proceedings. In my America, I have lost several family members who are in Mexico right now. In my America, I get a chance to work with youth who are the only ones in the country currently, and their entire family is in their country of origin. They have to be here by themselves, somehow support themselves, somehow get through school, and somehow, once they've gone through school, figure out a way to continue and to persist. In my America, I get the honor of knowing undocumented students who have refused to allow all the political and different constraints to restrain them. I know undocumented students in PhD programs, I know undocumented students who have graduated from law school, medical school, that's what my America looks like. And so, yes, I'm American, but my picture, my perspective is different. And I think that's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to allow folks to get a little glimpse, you know, at the very least, a small glimpse of what that looks like for us.
And Laura, we promised that we will explain the details of deferred action for those who don't understand it. It's kind of complicated. Do you think you could explain how it works for us?
Definitely. So a person who entered the country before age 16, so literally a day before turning 16, is eligible to apply as long as they have been present in the country from at least June 15, 2007 to June 15, 2012. Now, this person must either be in high school or in a GED program or have graduated with a high school diploma or obtained their GED. And one of the critical parts is that this person must have a criminal record that is near clean, which means no driving under the influence, for example, any misdemeanor that is more on the aggravated side, and definitely no felonies.
So, but you don't have to have a fully clean criminal record. You can have a misdemeanor.
You can, and there's certain exceptions for that, yes.
Okay, so what else? You have to pay a $465 fee, right?
Correct. You have to submit your biometrics, your fingerprints, and you have to be able to prove that you have not committed a crime outside of the United States, which for most students is simple because they might have entered as toddlers. Another thing that you must be able to do is provide documentation of that time. So transcripts are most essential for people to be able to demonstrate this, but for those who have been unable to continue on with their college education, some of the other documentation could be like bank statements or medical records, and definitely birth certificates as well. And where we come into, again, assessing the risk is whether students feel comfortable putting their parents' names out into the immigration system.
Meaning that their parents may not be documented.
Correct. And in that case, the student has to analyze, well, do I go through with processing this when in the back of my head I'm worried that they might come after my parents as well?
And so tens of thousands of young people have lined up to apply for this. Do you know anybody who's going through the process and what that's actually like?
At the moment, nobody has a complete packet. They're waiting on college transcripts, which are taking about 2 weeks, as I've been told. I'm still waiting on my own. And for those students, they really have to take into account all of what I said, but also if they send in an application and then it is rejected, they've just lost out on almost $500 between the processing itself, sending certification, getting copies of your transcripts. So it's something that students are very eager to send off, but we're also cautioning them to take a deep breath, like in the E4FC guide, to really analyze, is it a complete packet, and to talk to lawyers to make sure that there is really nothing in their own family history that can put them into removal.
And, how big of a barrier is that, those fees and those application process, Jillian?
Well, for many, the fees can become prohibitively expensive, and there are groups and there are public agencies that are trying to support students who are interested in applying. But I think it's really helpful to hear Lauda's very complete list. Folks can see it's a very lengthy application process, and there are a lot of hurdles that people have to clear before they get the benefits. And the benefits are very specific. It's a 2-year protection from deportation, and after that you have the right to apply for a work permit. The work permit does not come automatically. Well, the other thing is that if you're granted a work permit, the Obama administration has said that people can apply for a 2-year renewal. But the risk is, you know, come November, say Obama doesn't win re-election, there will be a new president who could do away with the program entirely, in which case the program could be off the table, and, you know, immigration officials would have scores of young people's information and the information of their families. And so it is there are real considerations to weigh.
How big of a fear is that for people? That sense that I'm giving over all of my information, sometimes information on undocumented relatives who then could be eligible for deportation.
It's a very real fear. And I think that's what we're starting to see right now. I think initially when the application came out, there was a lot of rush, there was a lot of urgency, and there was a lot of questions. I think now that we know in quite a bit of detail what the process is going to look like, we've seen the application, I think folks are starting to, now it's starting to become real. And I think that is one of the biggest challenges for our community is do I do this? And unfortunately, we can't guide anyone. We can't tell people that this is right for you. They have to, like I said, we encourage folks to go on our website, go on e4fc.org. If they want a preliminary analysis and they want, we have a comprehensive step-by-step guide. But they really have to make this decision for themselves.
And I know that a lot of nonprofits are stepping up to try and help people through the application process. I've also read, though, that there are for-profit folks cropping up that are charging big fees to take you through this application process. Have you heard of that? Everybody's shaking their head here.
That's always a risk whenever there's any sort of immigration relief, is that there are people out there to exploit people who want to, who need help navigating this very thorny immigration system. That's always a risk.
And I heard that somebody, a potential applicant, said it could take a year for his application to be fully processed. This is only a two-year work permit, ultimately. And we don't know what's going to happen in the November election. And some people are calling this the Dream Act Lite. Jose's shaking his head here. What do you think are kind of the pros and cons of doing this program, this executive order, this action?
Right. Well, I think first and foremost, it's important to recognize the work that was done to get this. I think that so many youth around the country, so many activists and so many allies really have been pushing, protesting, and a lot of them shutting down Obama's campaign offices in order to let him know that this is something that he needs to do. We knew that it was something that was in his power to do, to pass some type of administrative relief. And it is really because all of those folks risked a great deal in order that we have this policy today. So I think it's important to recognize that. But
this is really something that you in the advocate community had been pushing for.
For a while. Uh-huh. Absolutely. Absolutely. But
as an alternative to the Dream Act, though.
Exactly. Exactly. But this in no way is the Dream Act. Right. This is not a legal status. It is not a visa. It is not permanent. It is conditional. And it is temporary. Right. And I think what the Dream Act offers is an opportunity for a path to legalization, a path to citizenship for our youth. And that's something that we still need and we still need to work for. So I would not in any way confuse those two.
All right. And we'll talk a little bit more about the Dream Act and its status. Today we're speaking with Jose Arriola, who you just heard. He's the outreach manager with Educators for Fair Consideration. We're also with Julianne Hing, who's a reporter and blogger for colorlines.com, which has done some excellent reporting on this subject. And Laura Lopez is a legal advocate with Educators for Fair Consideration. And we're talking about the latest developments in immigration policy and what's being called deferred action. It's a water down version of the Dream Act. It allows young undocumented immigrants who meet qualifications to apply for a two-year work visa to the U.S. And we want to hear from you, especially if you're undocumented. We want to know if you're applying for this, what's your experience, what is it like to live without legal status, and if you're somebody who's an opponent of the Dream Act, we'd also like to hear from you. 866-798-TALK is the number to call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we'll be right back after this short break.
Tune into Cross Currents today at 5. We'll follow two undocumented students as they look at life beyond high school.
Yeah, like college is, it's kind of like my crutches to continue. But education is, I guess, a way of connecting myself to not only to like California and the United States, but to the world.
Life for undocumented students. That's today at 5 on Cross Currents.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about Medicare. Given the current controversy over Paul Ryan's proposal for the healthcare program, we want to talk about what exactly Medicare is and how it works. How many people use it? Who's funding it? How is it funded? How will it change with the Affordable Care Act? Friday, of course, is our media roundtable. We'll talk with journalists about the week's news. And today we're talking about U.S. immigration policy and Obama's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. It's being called the DREAM Act Light. But is it better than nothing, or is it potentially dangerous for undocumented young people? We want to invite you to join our conversation at 1-866-798-TALK. Talk. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also be anonymous. You can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can post a comment at yourcallradio.org. And we especially want to hear from you if you're an undocumented immigrant and have been in the U.S. most of your life or know somebody who does. We're wondering how that affects you on a daily basis and what you think of the Deferred Action Program and the DREAM Act. The number again is 866-798-8255. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And if you're somebody who doesn't support the DREAM Act and believes in strong immigration controls, we'd also love to hear from you and have you engage with our panel, 866-798-8255. Again, that's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. So we said that we would talk a little bit more about the DREAM Act, which I want to do, but we also want to talk about the broader immigration debate and policy. And Julianne, you've written about, or you've reported on the fact that despite this executive order by President Obama saying that anybody who's eligible for the DREAM Act would not be deported, you're saying there are still a lot of these dreamers sitting in ICE detention and being deported. So can you explain what's happening?
That's correct. And we know that because there are undocumented youth who actually have infiltrated, who have put themselves into deportation proceedings to see what's going on inside detention centers. When this order was announced in June, the Secretary of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, said that it was, you know, this end of deportations would be effective immediately. What we know, you know, today we're more than two-thirds of the way through August. There are still undocumented youth who are getting funneled through the deportation system. And I think this illustrates a couple things that people familiar with immigration have long known, which is that there is a fundamental disconnect from what's happening on the ground and the sorts of orders and supposed directives that are coming down from ICE and from the Obama administration.
What do you mean? So how does that translate? So Obama issues this directive saying no more deportations for this type of individual, and yet you're saying it is not translating to customs officials.
In this case, and actually in several others, the Obama administration has actually announced several reforms over the last few years in response to the fact that, you know, like you said, he's been really called out for being a deporter in chief. He's deported more people in his single administration than George W. Bush did in two terms. So he's really overseen a stunning uptick in immigration enforcement that's led to really aggressive deportation records. And so he's tried to reform things, but what we're seeing on the ground is that the reality is still that people continue to be deported for even people who should be granted relief.
And who's being deported? Mm-hmm. You know, as a general rule, it's over a million people in a three-year period, but who is being deported? Is it folks that were caught under secure communities who maybe have committed a crime, or is that not the majority?
Right. So secure communities, which is a program which allows immigration officials to look into the databases of anyone who is arrested, anyone who's booked in a local county or jail. That doesn't even mean people who are convicted. Even if you're just booked, immigration officials get to see your data, scan, you know, you against their immigration database, and then ask for a hold to be put on you if they want to look into your case further. That program has been largely responsible for a lot of the deportations that we're seeing these days. And the thing to note, though, is that secure communities and the Obama administration's other enforcement programs are on their face designed to go after hardened criminals, go after people who murderers or people who've convicted terrible crimes that we don't want in this country. But the reality is that the people who are getting swept up because of secure communities are everyday people who get pulled over because of a broken taillight, people who are caught driving without a license because their states criminalize having a license, people who are getting pulled over for very minor infractions, who are then getting shoved into detention and pushed out of the country.
That's Julianne Hing. She's a reporter and blogger for colorlines.com. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. I'm going to go to callers right now. I want to give out the number one more time, 866-798-8255. You can weigh in on the immigration debate or where you think we should be going with this debate over immigration reform and control in this country, especially in an election year, 866-798-8255. If you're undocumented, we'd like to hear from you. You can call in anonymously. And if you're somebody who opposes the DREAM Act and thinks that we need more immigration control in terms of reform, you can also join our conversation, 866-798-8255. And we're going to go to Anonymous in San Leandro. Welcome to your call.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I want to say why I oppose the DREAM Act. What's happening is that there's a unemployment that in California officially is 12%, but actually is more than 15%. And it's about the same in the rest of the United States. And so this government allows these people to enter the labor force, and that is going to undermine even further the wages, safety conditions, and all the labor rules. We are not talking here about immigration. I'm an immigrant, and immigrants who come here legally, I support those. But people who come here illegally don't have any right to work in this country. They actually, there's a law, a labor law, that you have to be a resident or citizen of this country to hold a job. And these people are looking for shortcuts, for loopholes, in order to undermine those laws. And that's to the detriment of the labor movement. I oppose them completely, all of them, not only the Dreamers, but all of the illegals.
So stay with us, because I want to get some response to what you just said. But really quickly, Anonymous in San Leandro, what do you think, though, about somebody who came here as an infant and had no control over that decision and essentially went through American schools, the whole system, and then is not allowed any path to legal status? What's your sense of those young people? Are you with us?
What was the question?
Let me get a response to what you said. So what he's saying is, you know, you're just looking for these shortcuts and loopholes, and that's not fair. It's not fair to people who came here legally.
Sure. I think the basic, if we're talking about basic economics of immigration, it's actually quite simple and pretty straightforward, even in the minds of most economists. By the most conservative estimate, in the U.S., the United States benefits to the tune of $20 billion a year. Because of immigration, and most economists actually say that gain would be greater if we actually allowed more paths to legalization or actually allowed more visas, allowed more folks to come in. They do not depress wages, and actually there's been a massive amount of research in this that was in a sweep of all academic research done about how immigrants influence wages. The only example that was found where immigrants actually depressed wages was a 0.8% depression in wages for folks that were competing with high school dropouts, and that's it. What I think is unfair, what I think really does need to be talked about is the way that folks are unbelievably exploited and mistreated. The people who form the very foundations of so many of our industries, right? Agriculture, service industries, garment industries, infrastructure building, manufacturing. So many of those are fundamentally predicated on undocumented immigrant labor, right? So the folks that pick our crops, the folks that build our roads, the folks that clean, all of those folks form a very pivotal kind of fundamental part of our economy, right? And what we've seen is, I think Alabama is a perfect example, right? So Alabama passes this really, really stringent immigration policy, right? And there's a massive exodus of undocumented folks, undocumented immigrants from Alabama. Now,
Which supposedly was the point of that, right?
So we keep hearing in the U.S., and I'm sure in Alabama, there's a ton of unemployment, right? Thousands, hundreds of thousands of folks that are unemployed. Well, guess what? There's now just a massive exodus from the agriculture industry. And what we actually found was that farmers and growers ended up losing hundreds of millions of dollars because no one came to work, right? And that's not to say that, I'm sure there were unemployed folks in Alabama. Why is it that folks don't immediately take those jobs? Right.
And one, just speaking of some of the myths that you guys might want to bring up, one thing that I understand is that undocumented workers do pay taxes and pay into the Social Security system that they are not eligible for. Are there any other sort of misconceptions or common misperceptions?
Go ahead. There are a lot. I'm not sure if I have time to get into them.
Let me go to another call.
Sure, yes.
You don't have to. The number to join our conversation about the DREAM Act, immigration reform, and the politics of immigration reform is 866-798-8255. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And let's go to Christmas in Monterrey. Hi, welcome to your call.
Hi. This is really very timely for me. I've been having a long-distance argument with a friend of mine who normally lives in California but went to Arizona in search of more construction work that he thought was there, and he's finding on his work sites that he goes to apply that most of the people that are working there are working under the prevailing, what used to be the prevailing wage, and they're undocumented, and he is just crazy. And I've talked with him. He's a guy who would be otherwise like a radical, way beyond liberal guy, and he's desperate financially, and I can see his side, but I also know that this is exactly the same thing that happened in the Depression. It was like the Okies were taking our jobs, the this were taking our jobs. It's just when times are desperate, people look for a fall guy, and I am so in support. I was in Mexico and in a desperate need of health care, and I got people there when I was traveling went out of their way to help me, and I didn't even speak the language. And I really, having experienced that just on, you know, a basis of a 2-month period, the depth of help that I got when I was a young person in a country that I didn't even speak the language and I was sick, I can see how hard it would be to be in a country, even if it's a country that you've lived in your whole life, and maybe even especially. I mean, those kids, those young people should get all the help they can. The border, I mean, this may sound a little bit crazy, but, you know, this was Mexico. Hello. You know, and, you know, it's just accidents of history that it's not anymore. And I don't know. The whole idea of borders, I think, is stupid in the first place.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Christmas. And she brings up the point of the politics of this in a time when we're in a tremendous recession and all of these laws have been passed around the country. In some ways, you could say scapegoating immigrants or targeting them in any case. What are the politics of this issue in an election year? And was this essentially a political move on the part of the Obama administration? Julianne, who wants to talk about this?
There's plenty to say about it. I will say to this caller, I think that she touches on a lot of the micro and macro dynamics of why it is that we are coming upon these tensions. But I think that, you know, one thing that I notice in a lot of the public discourse around immigration is that, well, as this caller said, immigrants make very easy scapegoats. But the fact is that, you know, it's not the presence of immigrants that's driving down wages. We should, you know, I think that when we think about economics and the laws that are demanding that push wages down, and also the policies that push migration around this country. You know, I think it would help people to understand why it is that immigrants are driven from their home countries and compelled to come to the United States in the first place.
And the vast majority of undocumented immigrants who are in the U.S. have been here long term. 86% of undocumented immigrants have been living in the U.S. for 7 years or longer.
And a lot of that is actually the result of more stringent border enforcement, which means, you know, in the past, we used to have seasonal workers who would come to the U.S. from Mexico or Central America, stay for the growing seasons, and then go back to their families. But because border enforcement has become such a priority, people come to the United States and they just can't leave. And so now, you know, we have trapped effectively 11 to 12 million undocumented immigrants in this country who are building community here, who are setting down roots, who are building families, raising families, starting businesses, and also risk never being able to be reunited with their families if they leave.
Well, but that's what the devil's advocate would say is, well, then go home, leave.
Yeah, it's a little bit more complex than that, though, because you know, free trade policies, NAFTA is the biggest culprit of this, have created conditions such that there aren't jobs to go back to in Mexico. You know, Mexican farmers just can't compete with American subsidized corn. And so people are coming to the United States because as long as there is work here that will pay something, or that will pay better than what people can get in their home countries, people are going to do what they need to do to take care of their families. That's the economic reality that
we're
facing.
And I know you want to get in here too, Jose, and I want to get to more callers. So just bear with me for a moment. One thing that I think is interesting in the current immigration debate is that we used to sort of glorify our immigrant past. I think at the turn of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, people did just get in line, and they literally got in line and could get legal status almost immediately. And now it's a much different system. People wait for years, and I think there's even a visa quota system. So to get a green card, only 25,000 green cards per country are issued each year. So if you're from a tiny country like, say, Latvia, you have the same quota as, say, Mexico, which is just an interesting piece of this puzzle. I know you wanted to say something, Jose, and then I'll go back to the phones.
I think that's a really great point, and I do think that it's important to have some sense of historical context about this. And as a history major, I think it's the place where we need to start. I'm under no delusion that the U.S. has really at any point in its history been a very welcoming country to immigrants. Consistently, if we're talking about Asian immigrants, Chinese, Japanese immigrants, Filipino immigrants, if we're talking about Eastern European immigrants, if we're talking about Latino immigrants, that at each point in this country's history when we've had a massive wave of immigration, those folks have been exploited, marginalized, and
vilified.
And vilified, they have, right? That they were these foreigners, that there were these aliens, and that alien, that terminology still prevails in our immigration law. And so that's our legacy, and so it does not surprise me at all, right, that we're at this point. What history also teaches us, though, is that eventually some level of integration will happen, right? And that's what actually provides me a lot of hope, is that immigration reform will come. Because it has to, because there are way too many people in this country for it not to.
And that's Jose Arriola. He is the outreach manager with Educators for Fair Consideration. You're listening to Your Call. We're talking about immigration reform and the DREAM Act and the deferral program that Obama just started. Let's go back to the callers. Jack and San Mateo, welcome to Your Call.
Good morning. This is like one of those onions you order at a restaurant where you peel away the layers and you find more and more and more. It's a very complex issue. I just want to say as a little bit of background, and then I'm going to make a quick comment, and I know you've got more callers and people to talk. Three of my four grandparents were immigrants. My ex-wife is an immigrant from Mexico. My partner of 10 years is an immigrant from the Philippines. My daughter is an attorney with the Department of Homeland Security in San Antonio, Texas, as someone who does work to deport people who she feels should be deported, men who are abusers of their wives, for example, people who have committed serious crimes. She is as liberal as I am, if not more so. She got me turned down to a group in the Bay Area called the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, for whom I volunteer helping people seeking asylum in the United States. My son is an attorney in Chicago working for the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund. So this is really, for me, a family affair. And given that I have taught ESL for more than 40 years, I have never had an ESL student from anywhere who was lazy, trust me. They have had one, if not two, jobs, and they are helping support family back home and sending money. And on TV, several times in the past year, I have seen reports out of places like Mississippi and Alabama with farmers who said, we are no longer able to hire undocumented workers. We have tried to find local workers. They come out and work for one day, and they quit because they can't do the work or won't do the work for the amount of money that they earn.
Well, thank you for that, Jack. And hold on for just 1 minute, because you mentioned this kind of having an extensive network and knowing more and more people and having these mixed status families. And as that happens, do you think that as people have more and more connection to this issue, personal connection, that that will help change the way we look at this?
Of course. It's like anything. I am a gay man, and as I meet more and more people, they say, you're gay? I never would have guessed it. As soon as you meet a gay or a lesbian person who lives next door to you, who was a relative, who was a colleague, people, those layers of ambiguity, those layers of stereotypes are pulled away.
Well, thank you.
Of course.
Thank you so much for that, Jack. And if you guys want to just quickly respond, I want to get to one more caller before we...
Sure, and I think he has a great point. And I think ultimately that's what changes things, is being able to actually meet someone who is undocumented, being able to actually enter into a discussion and a conversation about what is that experience like. And I think that's been really great about the work that I've done over the past 2 years, is I've met so many people, some of whom are very conservative, some of whom oppose this issue completely, who have been completely transformed simply by meeting me, simply by being able to ask questions and to realize, wow, you're not this image that has been perpetuated or created.
This abstraction.
On mainstream media and things like that.
Of a so-called illegal.
Right.
Let's get one more call in before we have to wrap up the hour. Anonymous in California, welcome to your call. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me. Jose, I just had a quick question for you. I was wondering, how do you deal with being undocumented and just trying to, you mentioned all of those things about, being taken advantage of and things like that. How do you rectify, your Mexican identity with your American identity, with all of the things that may have happened to you, and still come up with that equation of just being one with everyone, just being an American.
Right, right. Wow, that's a phenomenal question. I think I have to thank and really recognize my mother and father for that. I think my mother and father are the most hardworking and loving individuals I've ever known in my life. And what they've instilled in me from a very young age is that my goal in life is to make sure that in everyone that I meet, that I respect everyone that I meet, and that I give them unconditional love and as much dignity as they deserve, regardless of whether or not I'm recognized in the same way, or I'm respected, or I'm treated in a way that's dignified. That is the way I was raised, and I think it was really that foundation that forms a lot of who I am, the work that I do, and I can only hope that what I do contributes to a more just in a more equitable society, and that's what gets me up every day.
And we just have a couple of minutes left, literally seconds, for each of you to tell us what's next for this political movement. Jose, you said reform will come. How will it happen? Let's start with you, Julianne.
Well, reform is going to come in part because this is our demographic and electoral reality. Someone I interviewed recently said that, with the election around the corner, this past 12 months are going to be the most productive when it comes to immigration issues. And so, whether or not it's a cynical move or not, the elections are going to help drive the fact that change needs to come, and it's going to happen.
Laura, just a 30-second response to that same question. You there, Laura? Okay, then Jose, you get the last minute, last word here.
I think reform will come because it needs to. I think reform will come because so many folks around the country, I see actually a meme that's going around Facebook right now for the folks that do qualify for deferred action, and it says, I am still undocumented.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that prevail, that notion, that idea will continue to prevail, that even if I do get deferred action, I'm still undocumented, and my parents can still be deported. My parents, my family can still be removed. And so we need to continue to move and to push. And what this will do, I hope, is just bolster us. It'll bolster our allies. And then it'll allow everyone to see, in the end, how deeply interconnected we all are.
And that's Jose Arriola. He's the outreach manager with Educators for Fair Consideration. We were also joined by Julianne Hing, who's a reporter and blogger for colorlines.com. Earlier, we were joined by Laura Lopez with Scene, or she founded Scene, and she's a legal advocate with Educators for Fair Consideration. And we're going to put links to web resources at our new website, yourcallradio.org. We'll also put articles about these issues, the DREAM Act, etc. And you can post comments there and continue this conversation. That's at yourcallradio.org. And I want to thank everybody for joining us. Thanks for your calls. And I apologize that we couldn't get to all of them. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. How does Medicare work, and what's in store for its future? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the Medicare system, how it currently functions, and how it's set to change under the Affordable Care Act. Republican vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan has proposed a privatized voucher system, but critics say that could quickly become unaffordable for most seniors. If you're on Medicare, what's your opinion of how it should work? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also friend us on Facebook. Ali Budner and Malihe Razazan produce the show. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.